Yeah, so you've got really stereotypical someone dressed up as a faddy old cobwebby historian, male historian, and then this over boisterous, you know,
lively
American accent film director, you know. And it was supposed to be trying to get the children to see that, well, they were arguing out, I'm just making a drama. And so it was this really crude distinction between really the purpose of someone who's making a film and the purpose of the historian. And what the goal was, whether this was to try and show some difference in interpretation that they would have, but it wasn't even talking about what the interpretation was or what it was of. It was just, I'm going to automatically have a different one to you because I'm this and an historian's that, as though all historians will believe X and all film directors will do Y. So the whole thing was a disgraceful attempt to bring historical interpretation to Year 6 children by some wonderful initiative by a secondary teacher who thought, I'm going to help this primary school teacher. So, but have a look at it, see what you think. I mean, I was shocked, and I just thought, I don't know quite whether the HA are putting it there as an example of what not to do or what. But it's the worst example of teaching. And the children were just sitting there bewildered, really.
But this is precisely because nobody sat down and said, OK, what's central to a notion of interpretation history? So that if it just becomes the sources of interpretation are just different, or that people just have different ideas, or even that different kinds of people have different purposes, it reduces everything to terms that are likely to be assimilated by children to even more simple ideas.
And in history, it's actually reduced itself across. There's no progression, there's no build-up. It's just from content to content. It's whether someone's a hero or a villain or a goodie or a baddie.
It seems to be going back to the old traditional history.
Traditional history was never... Well, a bad traditional history. A lot of good... I mean, I was taught by traditional history, but we had to think...
But also, I think some people were claiming that we didn't get interpretation until we got the national curriculum, which is very odd, because...
That's what A-level used to be about, interpretation.
I can remember teaching interpretation to young children over the Norman Conquest and all sorts of things way before that, and you actually taught them genuine historians' arguments.
So there are some real made-up things being sort of put about, particularly in the basis of teaching history, about the history of history, which is just hilarious. I mean, they're just downright funny. You know, nobody said anything about interpretation or significance or indeed anything else until the national curriculum or shortly thereafter in some cases. And it's just bizarre.
You were saying that... you expressed some concerns about oversimplification of some aspects of the new curriculum at Key Stage 3, and that was what you were illustrating by that.
That's right, yes. And that inquiry, when the national curriculum first came out and I was in the advisory service, I can remember getting together with the Kent advisory teacher in Coulson. And we designed... some plans for the curriculum content organised around questions, but we organised them in terms of the concepts. So we looked for questions that would be asking for explanations, distinguishing, explaining actions from events. We looked for questions that addressed significance. We looked for questions that addressed a long-term issue of processes or change, continuities and things like that, and then evidence ones, interpretations, but inquiry questions. And in some senses that was one way of targeting and bringing together the concept, organising concepts and the content of the curriculum, and making sure it was embedded in knowledge. The inquiry questions seem to me more scattergun than that, because they are just looking at them as interesting questions. They're not attaching them to the nature, they're not looking at the nature of the questions. And therefore, when they're doing source work in connection with those inquiries, they're not looking for what would count as evidence within. So you tend, what I've seen going on, you tend to get it very much like an old CSE project where people are just looking for matching content stuff from, and it keeps it at a very information base level, and some of it also keeps it just a very descriptive level, so it's not very explanatory or anything. But, and I think there's an issue really about inquiry questions then presuppose the knowledge base that children are going to develop through that inquiry question, and no one's actually saying, what do these, if you pursue this set of inquiry questions, what does that mean? What does that amount to in terms of the knowledge children are all going to walk away with? And some of it will be as bizarre as knowing about Jack the Ripper, or, you know, it's all a bit, what would be an exciting question and what will make the children happy, mm-hmm. rather than what's actually important historical questions that we need to ask about our past. You know, in the present world, what's important?
As if children are only interested in the fripperies. I mean, just not, again, empirically, it's a mistake. Mm. And it's a mistake which often derives from teachers' own preconceptions about how kids are, and which aren't actually...
So it isn't that the idea of inquiry questions, I think that's important, but we actually need to look much more, okay, what are people doing with these?
Are there any materials that you would commend as actually demonstrating this more sophisticated approach to using sources or to setting inquiries?
The only good example so far, I mean, there are obviously things that you could say about it, but there has been some serious attempts, for instance, to locate some key events within a wider temporal framework. So the King John book by Dale Bannum, while it's examining...
Dale Bannum, yeah. Well, it's Bannum and what's his name?
And
oh, Keith, Ian Dawson.
Yes. They are trying to explore what King John... I mean, they are making judgments about King John, but they are looking at then interpretation of King John over time and the different interpretations. But they're also looking at some of the things that happened during King John's reign and exploring the significance of them in the short and longer term. So there are some organisation, well-organised textbooks that... have got a theme of their own and a purpose of their own, whereas many of them are double page spreads of different things and bits and pieces of inquiry questions. I think textbooks in the main are actually not very intellectually challenging. They're quite they're written quite a low level, and they place no demands on children conceptually or really in terms of reading and skills, and certainly not in terms of evidence.
If you compare a modern textbook with books that were written 20 years ago and what was expected for all quite ordinary children to do, it's really quite startling.
If you look at the original SHP textbooks and then the fact that people were saying, oh, this is for kids who can't do very much, and you actually look at the text within those and compare it with texts now, hugely different.
But it's important.
I mean, I know they're not as colourful and...
Yeah, but it's important in any case not to get into a pattern of, oh dear, the whole world's gone. Actually, I mean, there are all sorts of really important things. I think if you take a longer picture and don't get stuck in the immediate present as to what's happened with history education, are really very interesting sort of long-term developments. I mean, at the bottom of it is not, academic versus utility, as it were, and not the new history versus the traditional history, because that, as I said, those things are just myths and they never existed. Neither of those existed. The new history can mean all kinds of totally different things to different people, and the traditional history covered an absolute multitude of different ways of teaching and different things. Why are you asking that big question? Why are all these arguments agonising? I think you said. I mean, I think that the point about history is that, as John Slater said, quoting Khrushchev, history can spoil everything. I mean, history actually matters to politicians at one level. At one level, it doesn't matter. They can't think it's useful in turning out better employees, but they do know that if kids get the wrong history, that's serious. Meaning what they don't want the kids to get, and so they want the right stories. So it really history kind of oscillates in the public mind between being not worth talking about at all, and then suddenly something that kids don't know any of, and this is really serious because that means they're vulnerable to all kinds of rubbish, either American films that have the wrong people discovering the Enigma machines, or you know, all the things you can't possibly have them believe if they're going to be patriotic British citizens. So, because it has those different kinds of values in people's minds, varying from nil when we're talking about daily activities to absolutely crucial for political cohesion and all the rest of it, and because interest in those oscillates, you're going inevitably, continuously, to get arguments about history. I mean, these are never battles that you win. You just have to keep refighting those battles because you've got a lot of people with interests in changing history education who are not actually concerned with history education at all. They're concerned with what they see as social organisation and outcomes that they want to promote or to halt. And history is seen as having a role in all those other nefarious or laudable activities. Then you've got the actual teachers, many of whom don't actually think about why they're doing what they're doing, because nobody's ever actually helped them to think about those things. So what they know that they've got to acquire large amounts of information, they had to acquire large amounts of information while at university and at A level. And they know they had to organise it in complicated ways, and that is really quite difficult. And they're quite pleased with themselves for accomplishing that, quite rightly, and being able to do those things. But they know also that just telling kids they've got to do those things as well is actually a slightly dubious activity. And of course, the better ones amongst them look for explanations of what should happen in terms of thinking. And the ones who are perhaps a bit more laid back, think in terms of being exciting and interesting and so forth, and telling good stories, all of which are part of the picture, of course, but none of which actually work as really understanding what it is they're doing. And of course, that had all come to a head, really, in the late 50s and early 60s, and the history and danger stuff, of course, a bit later and all that. And out of that came SHP. But there were a whole lot of people thinking about those issues. And what came out of it, both at the Institute and in Leeds, really was a conception of what ought to go into thinking about that, which, as you said, it's a conceptual, it's a philosophical issue. It's an issue about the kind of substantive history that is involved here, given that we think certain things are important in understanding history. And it's empirical knowledge about learning and how children learn. And all those things, in a sense, if you're going to ask a serious question about what history education should be or what it can be like, those are things you have to know about. And the trouble is, of course, that very few people know about them. And it's much the same with education in general, of course. It's a bit like, we're saying coming, it's a bit like the state of medicine when people were very good at bloodletting or cutting off people's limbs extremely quickly. They had all the skills, but there was absolutely no basis for medicine. and we're very much in that sort of situation with a lot of educational debate, I think. But there has now been an impact from people thinking in terms of, we need to know some philosophy, we need to know some psychology, and of course we need to know a hell of a lot of history. And that view of things has now actually started a field. When I started, there wasn't a field. There wasn't even a patch of bare earth, really. But the Americans are now talking about a field, and they're now talking about what went on in Britain as the founding fathers of the field. Yeah. Because suddenly there is a real sense of what you would have to do to pursue this kind of thing. And what's interesting is it's spreading very rapidly. I mean, in Isabel Barker in Portugal, through the Portuguese domains, as it were, into Brazil, Taiwan, the Chinese are interested, Canada, America, Australia. They're all looking to various elements of the UK history tradition, which is seen as completely different from the rest of the world. Now, part of that tradition, they just see as the practical steps, the source work and all that kind of stuff. But of course, a lot of the more thoughtful ones don't see it like that at all. What they're seeing is the beginning of a serious inquiry into what history teaching can and should be like, which involves all those other things. Mm. And in Europe, there's a similar thing, though less reliant on the much different from the UK tradition, which has partly been provoked by the work of Jørn Rusin in looking at historical consciousness. Rusin is huge in most of Europe, either as somebody to be followed or somebody to be opposed. So throughout the world in slightly different ways, and much of it is based on what happened in this country. Mm. There are major changes in and the whole business of how you think about history education is opening up. Frequently opposed by certain kinds of historians, often backed by other historians, and again sometimes backed and sometimes opposed by elements in government who assimilate this kind of argument to their very simple notions of political change.
And none of them know the international conversation that looks to and admires the British tradition.
No.
And that's the odd thing. They have no idea that...
The British don't. Other countries do.
No, but that's what I mean. Yeah. I mean, our policymakers and our people who decide this on that, on the curriculum, don't realise that their moves are actually being watched and followed by the international community. Yeah. And some of the things, why could they have done that with that? So they're not part of the conversation that's actually an international one. And they have no idea how our place in there.
Now, I don't want to go back into just moaning about the current situation, but one of the unfortunate things about the present situation is it's quite clear that the way the national curriculum has generalised or claimed to generalise a kind of SHP approach, which it hasn't, incidentally. I mean, in many ways, it bears very little resemblance to anything in SHP, despite what people say. And the SHP conference bears no relation to SHP as it was originally understood. But what's happened in this country as a result of the national curriculum and the top-down reforms, which often have not been properly understood, is that much of history now in this country is talked about in terms of skills, in terms of activities, in terms of disparate fragments of bits and pieces, sometimes dignified with the name of inquiry. And of course, everybody can see, who stands back just for a moment from this, that this does not add up to a history education. That knowing a bit about the Tudors and a bit about Jack the Ripper and a bit about the Victorian is really not a history education. So things look actually very bad now. It's quite difficult because people are looking to England as having, England in particular, but England, Wales, Northern Ireland, to some extent Scotland, as having made these huge and exciting changes which have opened up the way history was thought about, are now looking and saying, but hang on, it looks as though a lot has gone wrong, which it has. But the danger is then, of course, that what has gone wrong will be dealt with in a certain sort of way. And you can see historians who've taken very little trouble to find out what actually happened in history education, have picked up bits about empathy or something like that, which they don't understand, and just mouthing off. I mean, there's one historian I'm thinking of, but I won't actually mention his name, who wrote a whole preface to one of his books in this vein, which just displayed monumental ignorance. But they're right in saying that kids have not any big picture of history which they can use. They're wrong in saying that it had anything whatsoever to do with the so-called new history, given that there wasn't a new history in that sense anyway, totally wrong. Because we can actually trace back, Sam Weinberg did it in a very amusing way in one of his papers, you can actually trace back the fact that people have always been saying kids have never had a proper picture of history. They've always said over a period of literally 150 years that kids don't know any history. Now, given that teaching methods have changed out of all recognition, society has changed out of all recognition, life has changed out of all recognition, an account of how why kids don't know any history that puts it down to the school's history project or something is plainly historically a little inadequate. And so the kind of problem then becomes, have kids ever, is there any evidence that kids ever had a workable big picture of the past? Now historians, of course, are inclined to say, well, I had, so it obviously worked. But of course they forget that they're the top 2% of the population with regard to what they got out of school history in the main, though some of them look back with some doubt on what they got out of school history. And of course, if you start thinking, if I actually said, what did I get out of school history? I got a story in which the middle classes made the world. The middle class is responsible for everything good in history, and the poor and the wealthy, and particularly aristocracy, was all catastrophic. And a story in which the British, through guts, determination and all the rest of it, civilised the world. And a good thing too. That's the story I had, basically. And so, quite surprisingly, within 5 years, it was turning out to be not very useful to me. So the answer is not that kids did know the perfect story and so on. And I had no coherent picture at all. I just knew that the British were good and middle classes were good. I had no big picture. I mean, we just did little bits of lumps and I'd forgotten everything that I'd done earlier on lower down the school, and just as kids do now if you do it that way. So the issue is, yes, it is fragmented. Yes, kids are not getting a proper history of their education. Yes, they don't know enough history. But the problem is a complicated one, and we don't know the answer. And people are just beginning to start thinking about that. There are real things happening now for the very first time in my 40 years in history education, where people are saying, okay, we've done all these other things, now let's turn and look at this. And there are real signs of that we may be able to find ways of doing this. I mean, one of them started with Dennis Shemmott and John Hamer, who said it's quite clear that if we're going to do this sort of thing, we have to do it very quickly. In other words, it's no good having a sedimentary model. This is my metaphor. It's no good having a sedimentary model in which the Saxons get depressed by the Normans, get depressed by the Middle Ages, get depressed by the Tudors, you know, and everything's forgotten in the lower strata, and the strata are just heaped. You've got to have a metamorphic one where they learn something very, very quickly and keep coming back to it. And this connects very closely with Rose's critique of SHP and was what got built into CHP, which is it must be nesting. You must nest depth studies into this big picture. But the big picture is not an overview. It's a framework which will develop into a big picture. It's not just, overviews tend to be strings of beads, you know, pools of light in a big darkness. It's got to be a notion of what's going on, of changes, of large-scale processes. Scale is crucial. It's different from doing the depth studies. And the depth studies have got to challenge these general picture that kids have, as well as reinforcing it. They reinforce it in the sense of strengthening it, thickening it up, making it more sensible and intelligible. But they also challenge it. To what extent is it just a generalisation, and to what extent does it help us understand this bit of stuff we're now doing in detail on the English Civil War, for example, or English, I shouldn't say anymore, but or to what extent does our picture of what was going on in, say, the 1640s actually affect the general picture we've got of the development of, say, English political life. Now, that's going to be very, very difficult to do, but there are signs. I mean, Rick Rogers and working with Dennis up in a Leeds school are already getting some really quite interesting stuff. And Dennis is going to analyse it properly and see exactly what can and can't be said on the basis of it. This is just tiny beginnings. Now, what I'm trying to say is that it's only because we've got some understanding of the ways in which kids' ideas about history can prevent them understanding history or going anywhere in history that we're even able to tackle this sort of thing now. It's only because we've got some picture of the development of kids' second-order understandings of history that we actually being able to turn to this issue of frameworks and find out what it is that for all these years nobody has ever managed to do, and why it isn't, why they haven't managed to do it. That still is a huge area, because in the 60s when I started, people were inquiring into the substantive understandings of kids. Said, what do kids understand by a monarch, by a revolution, by... And of course it turned out to be incredibly difficult to do, because they came at these things from so many different angles that you couldn't easily establish a progression model for key concepts, or even get any agreement amongst historians as to what key substantive concepts were. But that's a whole area that should be looked at again. There's a lady in Italy called Anna Emilia Berti who's done some quite good work. It's all Piagetian, and she doesn't understand some really important things. She's replicated some chatter work and got that around her neck, unfortunately. But she, in that field of substantive understanding, she's really got some working with other people. There's somebody called Bombi as well, Berti and Bombi. It's a good combination. But this is a whole area that also needs looking at in this country. But maybe it's the third thing in line. I mean, we've looked at second order understanding, beginning to get some sense of, we can at least make justifiable assertions about that. If we get frameworks and so on and big pictures thought about and some inkling as to how to do that, that will be huge. And then finally, perhaps another look at substantive understanding in relation to that. But one more thing in connection with this is kind of thinking in terms of a field with a theoretical basis here that's just sort of flickering into life, as it were, and flickering into life globally, not just here, though it definitely was started here. The Americans decided in about 1995-ish, may have got that date wrong, but that it was time to summarise the 30 years of work on the cognitive revolution, which psychologists undertaken, and they produced a digest of key principles of learning called How People Learn, which came out in 1999 or thereabouts, 98 or 99, which was the only book on learning theory that I've ever come across that was of any use to education and teachers. It was brilliant because it summarised really quite, in the present state of knowledge, indubitable, basic, simple principles for learning. And having published this book, which was really an amazingly good book, what it was, I mean, again, it was a real kind of sudden step forward. And they were looking around and saying, how can we transmit this to teachers? Because this is a book, not a particularly difficult book, but it's a book written in a general sort of way for people interested in learning in general. But okay, how would this work out for mathematicians and for scientists and so on? And then they thought, well, obviously we can do it in maths and science because there's work being done in that on the research side. But what else could we do? We ought to have a humanity. Well, what could we do in history? And they asked Sam, and Sam said the British could do it. So and we said, no, we won't do it without an American. But to cut a long story short, so we actually got asked to do the How Students Learn stuff on history. And that appeared in a great big book published by the National Academies. It was all highly prestigious stuff with millions of reviewers and all the rest of it. But that is an indication, if you like, too, of the way there is now a theoretical basis of the way it's international. Because if the Americans ask the British to help them with history education, that's startling in the sense that America, if you know anything about American history education, it's a very definite, the Americans control it, it's our story of liberty, you know, and so on. So it was a very brave move on their part, but it also, the point was, they didn't know anything about us. It was that the people in the field knew about us. So what I'm trying to say is there really is beginning to be an international field. There are recognised people now throughout, in various parts of the world, who really do have something to say, and it's growing now way outside us, way beyond anything we could have envisaged. And that's really exciting, because if looking back in over the 40 years, you said, what's changed? That's what's changed to me. And the ideas that started here, and which SHP was crucial in putting on the map, it got all sorts of things wrong, but impact was absolutely amazing, and it's that made people look at Britain and find out what was happening. But the, if anything, you know, really has changed, it's that those ideas have gone off planet. We're not subject to political asteroid strikes that will wreck those ideas in this country. They can happen now, but the ideas are out there beyond planet Britain and in America and all the rest of it. So it would take a lot of asteroids striking simultaneously to really knock this off. So that when you're asking about the debate, that debate is outside the hands of the British now. It's much bigger. It's taking place in all sorts of corners of the world, but along very similar lines. And that's really exciting. And it won't ever stop because people have their own interests in it. But what will happen is gradually, and then prediction based on history, what an idiot. But what's likely to happen, I suspect, is that because there is now some sense of what would constitute a theoretical basis for an argument about these things, it won't easily be knocked out anywhere. Because once it becomes something which academics have some sense of what the paradigm is, what the criteria are for an argument here, what you have to know about to make a serious contribution, once there's some agreement about that, then disagreement about all the substantive arguments within that is secondary. That's, in fact, that's exactly what a yes. discipline actually is like. Mm.
Mm. Did Chatter, the project that you did that to contribute towards the complete understanding then of how students learn that you use?
Complete?
Not complete, the understanding that you use as the basis.
It was a tiny little step. It was another step. Yeah, there is all, it, all
we
research
did
never
work as well.
Well, research is always, there's never a big thing that proves something. It's always incremental, really. I mean, there are sometimes things that shift the argument. But, and as Ross said, I mean, what questions we chose to look at in Chatter were decided by early work that Alaric and I had done together, hugely more by work that Ross and I did in Bramston, because we knew roughly already the kinds of range of responses we were likely to get. What we didn't know is how far they
that's
were just
generalisable beyond.
That's right.
Our teaching and the school I was working in.
So Chatter was big for the kind of thing it was. There were there were a lot more than 400 kids in the sample, but because we asked,
and we did pilots as well. Didn't
we did,
we?
But because we asked for triangulation, in other words, the kids all did three whole ranges of tasks on each on accounts, evidence, explanation, and so on. They did each of those in three different substantive areas of history. So there were three task sets. So we wanted to be able to triangulate, so we knew that it wasn't just the content that was decided. And because of that, a lot of kids dropped out because they weren't there for all three things. So by the time we'd weeded out the people for whom we hadn't got three task sets worth of stuff, it was down to 320. But that was just the first phase. The second phase then looked at another roughly 70 or 80 kids. And then the final phase followed in the end 10 kids through 3 years of primary school.
That's a progression.
And looked at that, but we never published that stuff. I mean, partly because basically there was no funding to continue, and partly because the Institute stole the money. They had a policy of taxing research grants, and there was money that we had hanging about to do some things, and by the time we got around to doing it, they'd pinched it all. If ESRC ever knew that, it'd be quite interesting. It's a form of embezzlement, really, but it was going on. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yes, but what have been the lessons coming out of Chatter for history teachers, do you think?
I mean, if you ask what's the lessons for history teachers, the answer is none whatsoever. I mean, Chatter wasn't intended to give lessons to history teachers. What it was intended to do is to provide more evidence about the kinds of ideas that teachers might encounter that would help or hinder, they were blockers or builders, for kids' understanding of history. Now, to the extent that teachers understand those and think about those, they may be extremely helpful for teachers. But they're nothing as definite as a lesson.
I've used it in bringing the knowledge base, the research knowledge base, to PGCE students to show that, and in a way this links for the wider assessment for learning research, because of the idea that when you're teaching, you need to have the kind of teaching and learning dialogue that reveals pupils' thinking to you, and to have some sense of what that's likely to be, and chatter in many ways identified the kind of thinking and the kind of range of thinking that you're likely to have in a classroom, then with that knowledge in mind, teachers are able to make decisions about the kind of cognitive challenge that thinking in a certain way might need, to attempt to dislodge that kind of thinking and to offer some kind of challenge that might edge them towards something else, so that they can see that they're going down a dark hole with this one, whereas if you could get them over here, they can actually get into the light and be a bit. So in that sense, it's attached to the notion of a feedback loop, and the way in which assessment for learning works in that you're putting yourself in a position where you can diagnose in the classroom, in an everyday teaching environment, how kids see what it is in connection with your goal. And then the big question is, if they're here, there and there, how are you going to get them to your goal? What's the best way to get them to your goal? And what interventions, what challenges, what learning opportunities do you need to produce? And whether some of the ways in which the children expose what they do think, how do you use that to try and expose the error of thinking in that way? And in a way, with the progression models that we were able to produce on the basis of the chatter research, that does give teachers behind the scenes at least some handle on planning. Okay, so let's imagine that we're going to teach this lesson with this goal in mind, and we find these things, this range of understandings. What kind of conversation, how are we going to direct this conversation? So it can actually support teachers' planning, but they really have to understand that progression not as a marking kids in terms of a mark scheme, but as a teaching tool, really.
But it's your notion of cognitive challenge is crucial there, because unless you understand challenge. What the big moves are between certain kinds of ideas, I mean, especially the move from testimony to evidence, for example, if you're thinking about evidence, it's a huge step. And unless you understand what kind of step that is and what's likely to keep kids thinking as a level of testimony rather than understanding what historians do at the level of evidence, unless you understand what's involved in that, and unless you understand what kids are likely to assimilate, then your chances of actually getting to evidence are drastically reduced.
And that actually connects very clearly with some of the unjust criticisms aimed at the Unseen paper in of the SHP program, because you get to start reading all these criticisms about short sources and long sources that people talk about with source work. Now, if you're doing some general inquiry where you want sources to give kids just a ton of information, a long source is fine. If you want to get them imbued into some enriched part of what somebody in the past is saying about something. But if you actually want to draw their attention to conflicting information within this testimony and within this testimony, if you hide it in a lengthy text, children, what we found in the research was children are very, very good at. One of the things we did was gave them three historical claims and some sources that they could use as a set to test those claims. Now, what children did was they took the story they liked best, the claim they liked best, and then they found what they needed to support it. conveniently ignoring others, even though these were short sources and this stuff was really up front. But it was, we followed through then, where once they'd made those sorts of moves to provide a cognitive challenge, we then drew their attention to the conflicting information and said, you know, how do you resolve this? Well, they can't just, you know, they've got to make, what kind of move can they make here? Either just that, well, one's wrong, one didn't know what they were there, one's telling a lie, or they can actually look at the context presented by the source set and find a way through that actually enables them to transcend the conflict. But if you then say, oh, short sources, again, it's what it depends what you're doing. It depends what your goal is, what you're testing. And to hide conflicts from children, if you want to bring them up against the conflict in sources, is giving them a skills problem while you're trying to sort out a conceptual issue. And so people make statements about good practice, like you shouldn't have these short gobbets, you've got to have these long things, and as though good practice exists independently of what you're trying to achieve or what your goal is. And for some purposes you want long sources, and for others you want gobbets. And so it's those kind of prejudices that don't see the point of some of the exercises and then turn them into exercises that won't do the job the first one was designed for, that become problematic. And I mean, you reach a point, you just think, where can you even begin to sort this out with these people? And of course they're preaching these things to students and all that sort of thing, this is bad, this is good, without understanding why did, you know, nobody says, why did they do that then? Why did they do that when they didn't have to? Was it because they just wanted to be horrible to kids or use things that weren't credible? So there's those kind of tensions in the system, I think, where people get on their high horse about things. I mean, one of the things is that at the Institute we've been very lucky because we've been able to work as a team, because we've always had a large number of PGC students that support a higher staffing level than most other history education outfits, who are people working on their own. So when we make assumptions about what other people are doing, we keep one another in check, don't we? There's quite a large group of us. And so we have had some huge advantages, I think, at the Institute. We've had some struggles because it is the Institute and not a small outfit. And of course, history within a large outfit doesn't.
But there's also been a tradition in this. I mean, there has been a tradition because of what Burston set out, and I say he's a very big man, sometimes, but it's really something of an achievement what he started off. He's not recognised anywhere, and I think that's bad, because although, as I say, though he was a problematic character, and some of the things he said were very odd, and he was definitely kind of reactionary and inverted commas politically with regard to education. Nevertheless, what he set up and his knowledge of how it should be set up, it's really important. A little story. Sam Weinberg, who's probably the best known person outside the UK that UK people know of, and certainly one of the two or three top people in the States and in the world, who has all sorts of clout now in American policy making and so on. Now, when Sam finished his psychology, he'd done history and then went on to psychology. And when he wanted to actually start doing research in psychology, he wanted to do it in history. And so he went to Shulman, who was his mentor, at least I think it was Shulman, either Shulman or Brophy, but I'm pretty sure it was Shulman, and said, this is what I want to do. And Shulman says, not a field, there's nothing in it, there's nothing written. Got to do it in English. So Sam went away thinking, I don't want to do it in English. And he wrapped it around and he found the book that Alaric and I had edited, well, two by then, and he went back to Shulman and said, there is a field, here are these two books. And so, you know, again, it shows how tiny the whole thing started out as. And it's only because of Headley that, and what Don did after him, and Arik and I, independently what Peter Rogers did, to some extent independently Martin Booth, though much less independently, and of course what Dennis did with SHP, but then that's it. That was all there was. But independently, people were coming to the same idea about the kind of things that, and it was only because there was that in the US, in Britain, that Sam was able to start off in that direction in the USA. And he actually said to us, he went and got the books, he said, I can tell you when I read these, they saved my life, because they enabled me to do what I wanted to do. So it's a tiny little thing that's grown enormously. But going back to what Ross was saying, I mean, one of the things that we have to say is that it is still only at the very beginning. And that when you said, you know, what are the lessons of chatter? And that's why I said there aren't any. Because research doesn't have lessons, what it does is it points helpfully at certain things if people are willing to be helped, if they actually want to do the work which would enable them to be helped. And there are plenty of teachers who do. And there are plenty of teachers that when Ross starts them out on that direction, or they come to do a PhD or whatever, and just go, ah, because they instantly see, here is a way of doing things which avoids everybody just having their opinions and shouting off. But the trouble is, most of the history education world is still just shouting off and having opinions. I mean, that's why I try and just basically keep quiet when I write some stuff, because you know that what will happen is if you say things before people have actually done the work, they will misinterpret them themselves and say, I mean, we've been told that we're advocates of what was it? Drama in the classroom.
Where anyone got that from? Never done a role.
The number of things that we've been put down. And so part of you just says, we don't want to be known by anybody except researchers or other people who are thinking at a reasonable level and are serious, rather than the preachers. So I react when people say, what lesson? Like, oh, no, not another lesson.
But one of the criticisms of chatter was it didn't grow out. It was nothing to do with classroom.
Yes, which is totally ignorant.
Connected it with classroom practice. And I thought, not a single person out there that can comment on anything has ever done so much classroom-based.
Yes, no, it's the longest piece of classroom-based research that's ever been done.
Yeah. We were in history. Every lesson over 6 years, and we got all those tapes and listening to all those children grappling all those history things, and then people just say things like
but
that.
But what's remarkable is that people feel free to say things like that without ever even thinking, can I say this? And the people who said this actually are rather amongst the better people than the people who said this. I mean, they're actually quite thoughtful people, but just astonishing that what people are prepared to say without knowing anything. That's why I say his education,
like,
is really
something to take to the classroom.
I mean,
and just
the standards in education. If I go to a conference where I'm dealing with philosophers, or one where I'm dealing with scientists, we had to go and tell, we were invited by the National Science Foundation in the States to go and talk to physicists about progression, because the historians actually knew more about progression. The historians in Britain knew more about progression than the scientists did in the States. That was quite fun. But when you talk to serious academics, either historians or philosophers or scientists in those fields, the level of conversation you have compared with the level of conversation you have with educationists is just in a different league. I fear education is still the home of people who feel free to say what they like about everything and anything without knowing anything, or even knowing what would count as knowing something. Again, that's why I'm emphasising what you said, you picked that up very quickly, the psychology, the philosophy and the history. They haven't even got that far enough to even recognise what they would need to know to be able to talk seriously. And we know almost nothing. I mean, I have to, again, reiterate this. What we know is just the very, very beginnings of things. We have better grounds than most people for asserting things about history and about how children learn and so forth.
And if there was more money in the system, you could have had bigger teams and include more people, and you'd have
smarter people too. Smarter than us.
And we could know so much more. But of course, history's not top of the list for. It's top of the list for arguing about, but not top of the list for funding.
But there is a beginning now. There is a beginning, and it is globalising. And so in one sense, although I'm horrified by most of what's said in this country, and a lot of what's said elsewhere as well, there are people in each country now who are capable of talking sense and know they've got to do some work before they open their mouths. And that's really, really, that's really nice. I mean, that really is encouraging.
So you feel optimistic?
Yeah. Well, optimistic for the field. I don't feel optimistic for this country or that country or whatever.
I feel
because
very
pessimistic about it. It is a case of asteroid strikes. These things can be knocked out at any moment in a particular place.
Yeah. I think the more and more the history community claim they can do all these other things, then there's nobody arguing for why history in itself is important. Because nobody's arguing for history, they're just arguing that history can do all these other things, and that is, and therefore you don't need it, do you?
No.
Because, and that was the point Dennis made when he, in his evaluation study, Dennis knew that the arguments that the SHP creators had put forward for the importance of history would not hold up for history alone, and he made that
additional thing
which gave it a whole new emphasis, and that was such an important move. And that really, those goals have got to be built on, and we've got an organisation called SHP still based in Leeds. It's nothing to do with any SHP principles and has no coherent goals of its own. The national curriculum clearly doesn't have any coherent goals of its own. So despite having, what we've got is a set of regulations that are interpreted differently everywhere and done for different reasons and are really just being adapted to do everything else, with no assessment program that's in any way moderated at all.
Well, the high stakes assessment actually is dumbing things down.
So why is anyone taking any notice of the national curriculum? I mean, why bother taking any notice of it? It's redundant.
And if you look at what actual history kids know as a result of doing most of what they do, again, there are very large numbers of exceptions to this, but still a large proportion of kids are doing itsy bits of nonsense. I mean, they know little bits about Henry VIII's wives and Jack the Ripper.
Because it's got to be fun. You don't need to go to school to have fun.
And that's been and it's justified on general skills grounds, because it turns them into better fodder, as he was suggesting
earlier.
It'd be
cheaper to plan trips to the park, wouldn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, non-graduates.
They'd get more fun out of Tolkien. Why do they need to read that? Yeah, all this other stuff.
And of course, with some examples, it doesn't even have to be true.
No, that's what I meant about the Tolkien rules.
Yeah.
So we'll have to hope that ultimately things will change.
Well, I think these battles are never won. Because there are all sorts of extrinsic issues about. So, which is why I'm pleased that in the wider world there is now at least just the tiny flickering beginnings of a discipline. Discipline's too strong, but a field where there are recognised criteria and people know what counts as an argument.
You've got one hell of a job now.